want insight and solutions? You're in for a unique experience, one where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia Sun.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. I'm Patricia Sun, and today on Trust the Problem, we're going to go right into it because, one, I've been receiving some emails, several different ones with different questions that seem to really converge on the same question, so I want to be sure to address it today. It's a similar topic. It's one I've certainly talked about before, but it's the kind you can talk about forever and never complete it, really, with all the things that are going on in the world right now and with the way that we're all working it right now to become more conscious. So on Trust the Problem today, what I'm going to talk about is creativity and denial. And they are related, and the subtitle is The Dark Before the Dawn. And I've often used this expression, the dark before the dawn, because it's a famous old, I think, Celtic idea that there is a special darkness, a special kind of lack of light right before there is light. Maybe it's what the eye gets used to, I don't know. But there is a special darkness before the light, metaphorically speaking, in consciousness. And I've noticed it not only in my own opening and working, but as I worked with other people throughout the years, I always noticed that there really was a funny dynamic that, for instance, right before I would do the most knockout best workshops I ever did, there would be some difficulty, some problem, some hassle, some sadness, some something that would come up that would kind of like set me back, knock me back. And I think, oh dear, I'm right about to do the workshop. I don't want to be thinking about this. And then I thought, well, this is what it's all about. Think about it. So I would. And what would happen is that almost at the 11th hour, 59 minutes before the workshop, there'd be this flood of energy. And I would realize the solution. And, of course, that would give a knockout workshop because I would be bringing in this energy that was transformative in a very, very profound and real way to me personally, as well as, I believe, collectively, because we're all connected. And this is one of the secrets. This is one of the pieces of the real truth of unraveling. Many of you know I've been lecturing for over 35 years. Hard to believe now, but anyway, I have. And I've seen my work in print, not under my own name, lots and lots of times. And the thing that's always sort of bothered me most about it is that there'll be some good phrase, I will think it's good anyway, and then something following that's all over the place, that's full of baloney, that's not it. And I think, well, you know, it's because they don't really get it. They get that it's powerful, they get it's something important, but they don't get the essence. And our creativity is what is released when we pierce through that not knowing, when we really don't know. And that's the denial. And the denial is one extra ingredient. It's not knowing, but it's not knowing on purpose. So there's a couple of extra dimensions here. But to get to the creativity for a moment, creativity, you know, means something out of nothing. It's something that didn't exist before, and then it comes into being. We have a hard time with that. Most people who, like in schools and school teachers, they may say somebody is a creative student. But creative students almost never get A's. Creative students are usually quite a frustration to the teacher because the teacher is trying to get everybody to do something. A creative person is always going to be thinking outside the box. They may be quiet. They may be kind. They may not be flamboyant. Some are flamboyant. Some are not. Different personality types. But the creativity part is the ability to think something that was never thought before. And in fact, I saw briefly, I couldn't almost bear to watch it, a show on TV about genius. And, you know, I thought, well, here's the blind leading the blind, because you don't really know what genius is. And interestingly, the word genius comes from Genesis. And Genesis means first there was nothing, and then there was something. And that's creation. So creativity and genius are out of nothing, something. Out of the intuitive, out of the depths, out of the sea of the galaxies, out of the cosmic consciousness, however you want to call it, out of the mind of God, out of the Holy Spirit, out of some kind of records. But it isn't a record. It's something that comes into being that wasn't there before. This is an intuitive thought. This is real creation. This is the true meaning of authorship. We have almost no authors left. We have a lot of scribes, a lot of people, interestingly, writing down stuff of other people, with a few things of their own experience thrown in, but mostly philosophical teaching, real revelational thinking, especially in these days, is not going to be something really prone to be written down. Perhaps it never was, I don't know, but I know it's not now. And it is because for human beings, after we learn to write things down, which was a great revelation and a great asset in our intelligence and collectively handing information down, so we didn't have to reinvent the wheel every generation. It was wonderful. There was, of course, verbal traditions. They were even more powerful. And the reason why they are more powerful and why stories are so powerful and storytellers are so powerful, the reason why art is so important is because it is the name we give to that unsayable talent to plumb into that which wasn't and create something that is. It's where you get the ideas that never were before. And stories, like parables, as Jesus used to say all the time, for all those interested in listening to the Bible literally, there is not a literal interpretation of the Bible to be had. Because it is an intuitive document. It is a spiritual document. And spiritual words must be read poetically, metaphorically, and in parable. Because, as Jesus made great pains to say, that all great teaching comes in parable. Because you can't understand the word. You can't understand it. You can't get what it is if you don't let this parable, this new thought, come into being. We are all in the midst of an evolutionary leap, is sort of my premonitional position. And because we're in the midst of an evolutionary leap, we're about to think things leap into another level of being, another level of consciousness. So to be the more, to be open to the more, is the creativity. This is the new thing. And this evolutionary leap is no small thing. And this new looking at things in a new way is no small thing. But it's huge. But it has no box, really, in our culture, in our mentality at the time. You know, we skirt around it in many ways. We have many famous teachers who think about it. But we don't really find it, in the sense that we skirt around talking about how something could be good or poetically, but to really live the radiance of this next level of thinking is to be open to telepathy, to be open to the intuitive feeling one person to another. This opening of feeling is the essence of creativity. It is something that requires transparency, that requires you feeling the other person and letting yourself be felt, seeing the other person and letting them see you. This is why when I first started thinking about all of this incredible quality and how people suffer over their sort of aloneness in their own judgmentalness, their own fears, their own thinking they're wrong. They don't know what's going on. Everybody else knows what's going on, but they don't know what's going on. That terrible sense of inadequacy that all people go through at some point. And I remember when I was a little kid, I was at a school, I was going to, I guess, I don't know, 7, 8, maybe 9. Hard to say exactly. But anyway, I was on a school bus, and I remember thinking about how people all worried about the same thing and didn't know it and thought they were the only ones. And we were just starting to learn algebra. And I realized how our algebra with the equation, you just cross off on one side, you cross on the other side, and it reduces the formula so it's clearer to see. You just get rid of that duplication on each end so that you're left with the essence of the difference. And I was thinking, oh, that would be great if everyone could read everyone else's mind. What would happen is that everybody, like this algebra problem, they'd see they all have some of the same worries, and they would cross each other out, and what would be left were the things that we really had as differences that we needed to talk about, understand, or work on. And it seemed like such a great idea that I blurted out loud on the school bus, wouldn't it be great if everyone could read everyone else's mind? The bus went silent, and then there were a lot of no. This deep, scary no. And I thought, whoa, that means something. That is a very scary thought to people. I wonder why it's so scary. So I spent most of my life trying to figure out why that's so scary, and I figured out a lot of it. And it really is part of this denial that blocks our creativity in the dark before the dawn, is that we are in the dark. We think we're more alone than we are. We think we're more different. We think we're more wrong. And where we're really wrong, we're often just trying to justify the heck out of it and not face it. So we would have to change and be different than everybody else. So it's a funny paradox. But that's sort of what's going on in explosive, big time all over the planet. And especially, I think, in America, where we have made our sort of, or allowed our representation to be not only in the government, but in the media, generally speaking, very much living in a denial, simplistic world, either-or thinking. It's been a problem on television for decades that, and progressively worse every year, that people got fame by just being polarizers. They didn't have to have anything worthy of anything to say. They just had to scandalize somebody and get somebody else hot under the collar, and then they made millions. And so it got to be a tactic, and then it got to be a way of thinking. And now everything is so simplistic, you can't find out what's happening. It's very difficult. And this is all part of that creativity and denial and the dark before the dawn. So for me, what the dark before the dawn is that it is the dark before the dawn is the moments, this time where all our shadow accumulates, ergo the dark, where all our unconscious stuff, that particularly the part that's not good, but also things that are wonderful, but that we don't understand or fear. And all of this is squished into this place as it rises in this dark before the dawn. It gets bigger and bigger, and it gets more and more of it. And it gets so intolerable, we go into denial all over the place. And we try to create cultures of denial and family systems with denial. And there's all this operation going on to deny what is burgeoning, what is starting to rise inside of us. And so for me, that's the dark before the dawn. And that's where we are in our country. And the good news is that at some point, this denial, bit by bit, starts to break through. And like the little boy with fingers in the dam, you know, he's holding back the whole dam, but at some point, when the finger comes out, the dam starts to crack, and then the whole thing comes flooding through. And that's the dawn. That's the evolutionary leap, and that's the next level of being. And we need all the shadow. We need all of it so stereotypically ripe and blatant in our faces so that we won't... How long will we deny the emperor has no clothes? How long will we keep saying, oh, his clothes are beautiful, everything's fine? How long will we do that? And it bit by bit, it starts cracking. And the second point I wanted to make for people, apropos to some of these emails that I've received, is that this is very exhausting for people. Very, very exhausting. And I really want to acknowledge that. I had a really fabulous email, initials MW, he'll know. But he asked some really great questions a couple weeks ago about how does the immature mind, the mind that hasn't realized it's loved and that it's developed or has ability to develop, and the mind that does not realize that, what is it that makes it go full tilt to forget, to trust any problem, and more, get a head of steam immediately and be very seduced and seducible into just believing an outrage, and to have their own feeling of outrage sort of dumped on somebody else? And he's talking about parents who treat children with such ignorance that it's appalling and it sends shock through them. And it's like it's so difficult for them to get a sense of what to do. And then he said, I guess my real question is, what allows the knowledge of love to go more and more through us until the inner animal no longer takes over with its lack of gentle firmness and unnoticed tone of judgmentalness when it takes action as a parent? Well, it's done step by step, and it's done by self-observation and self-correction. To begin it, there has to be some piercing through the veil of denial that says there's a problem. That's why people escalate and escalate, and people torture children literally, kill them literally, in the name of discipline, in the name of venting something. I mean, I can remember years back when I was going to Berkeley at university there, and studying psychology and reading case histories, you know, and people were going to beat the devil out of a child, a little kid, and just totally be oblivious to their own insanity. And that is extreme, but we do it in lesser degrees, and sometimes not so lesser, really. Lesser in the sense that a person who's otherwise a very nice person and seems pretty normal can go off tilt on doing some really excessive, cruel, horrific behavior to a child that they do love, I believe, often. But in that moment, the child is something else. It's some kind of demon. It's their shadow. It is their unowned shadow. And the reason for this, it's an ancient, not ancient, but it's an ancient happening thing, but a recently psychologically described thing called projection. When I say recent, last 100 years. So what people do when they have all this pent-up shadow is they always need an enemy. They need to have someone to vent it on so that they can absorb the oxygen in the room with their own mind, so they can absorb up any leakage into self-reflection. And it's why people who are particularly brutal or unconscious or megalomaniac kind of thinking, so they're delusional about their importance, they don't want any self-reflection. reflection. They don't want to hear about a criticism, that that person is attacking them if they say, excuse me, you're hurting my foot with that boulder you dropped on it. You know, then you're attacking them. That everything is put in, you know, that sort of narcissistic, self-absorbed focus, because that energy is necessary to keep away revelation, to keep away self-awareness. Now, just the way AA works, and it's so wonderful, when it's wonderful, it's not always wonderful, but when it is wonderful, it's really terrific. And what happens is that people speak more honestly about their stuff in front of other people who have very good, you know, BS detectors that pick it up as soon as they start to lie, because, you know, when the liar lies to the other liar, covering up the same kind of energy, it stands out. And the only way you ever see it better, I guess, is when you've been there, processed it, and are fully through it. Then you see it, and you see it with compassion, not with attack. But you spot it. And that's the growing up. That's the place we're looking for. So instead of trying to go backwards and appear good, we have to go forwards through our stuff, feel it, face it, redigest it, and go through the process of healing. I'm very much reminded that George Bush said, I heard him say a few weeks ago, really, not that all that long ago, he said, I'm not interested in process. I'm only interested in winning. And acted as though it was with an air of superiority that he had no interest in process or self-contemplation, as though that made him more pure. Well, it makes him more purely not aware, which is the goal, of course. And people follow people who think like that because they have their own wounds and they need that oxygen sucked up too, so they don't have to see them. The paradox is, of course, and the inevitable truth is, the wound only gets worse. It's just like a drug addiction. Take the drug, you feel high, you feel so much better, and you think, oh, great, I figured that out. Now I never have to look at that pain and that stuff. I just have to take this drug. And that's why all addictions, whether it's sex or drugs or just denial, and indeed we are addicted to denial, which is stifling our creativity, but it is also building a big dam that has a lot of cracks in it. And a lot of people got their finger in the dam. But one by one, they're going to start to take it out, and then there's going to be the flood of dawn light. And so that's the good news, metaphorically speaking. That's what's sort of happening. And I did want to address also, before I go into that, I want to just finish with this one listener, because he was asking, in addition to what is the mechanism here to allow love to get through to people so that they don't just behave in a reactionary, judgmental way. First, you have to understand what reactionary judgmental comes from, which is what we just talked about. But the other thing he was asking, what helps you develop personally your own awareness of your own attitudes? Because it's hard, he says, to smell your own breath. It's hard to know yourself. And when we're touched to the quick, that means that we have been touched in a place where we have a deep wound that is aching to be healed. Now, this is how you do it. I'm telling you how you do it. How you do it is you recognize that when you're touched to the quick, when you, quote, lose it, when you're most fearful, is when you have touched the very thing you have to look at and change and heal and release and process and understand. And what we would prefer to do is leap over it and act out with all this crooked energy, all kinds of dominating, superior, megalomaniac ideas. You know, several of the people who have plagiarized some of my work, I really noticed that they're starting to hit that point And it's really too bad. I mean, I'm happy for them to have used it. All they had to do was mention it. But because they snuck, because they tried to cover it up, what happens is that leaves, people call that bad karma. People used to always say to me, oh boy, are they getting bad karma. Well, in a way. But you know, karma isn't punishment you get for doing something bad. Karma is the result of what you get when you keep holding on to something that is bad. And the way you stop holding on to something that is bad is you face it and you do your best to rectify the wrongs. So getting back to AA, that's how AA works, is you have people with these good detectors to tell when you're jiving them and when you're being full of it. And they also give you the opportunity, and it's in the process, the rules of AA, the most important one from my point of view in terms of really releasing yourself to creativity and enlightenment rather than just surviving, not taking a drink or needing to be numbed out in some way and not become a dry drunk and still mean and judgmental and all the same psychological difficulties though you're not drinking. Make the real leap. You have to face what you have done with the spirit of rectification. Not even just reconciliation, but the spirit of rectification. So, as in South Africa, it's truth and reconciliation, truth, and rectifying, making amends for the wrong. This is the key. When you asked how, when my listener asked how, first you let the alarm say, I'm losing it, there's a wound. Second, dig into the wound as your wound and see what it is, even if other people are doing things and often they aren't. But look and see what your wound is. And then look and see where you may be blind around it and what you can do to rectify the wrong of any response. So we're going to take a quick little break here for some appeal from our sponsors. And you're listening to Trust the Problem, and I'm Patricia Sun, and we'll be right back talking more about this.
Trust the Problem is sponsored by a nonprofit organization, the Institute of Communication for Understanding, ICU. We rely on you, our listeners, for donations to keep us on the air. To help, please visit patriciasun.com and receive a free Can't Take Sides When You Know the Earth is Round t-shirt with your donation. Thank you.
Welcome back to Trust the Problem. You're now listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. I hear our music in the background. Okay, there we go. So we're listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. That's me today. And what I'm talking about is creativity and denial, and the sort of subtitle is The Dark Before the Dawn. And trying to catch up on some of my listeners' emails, questions, and to explain some of the feelings that are going around. Another person was recently telling me, in fact, at least three different people have said almost identical things, which is that people are so knocked out, they're almost like in bed knocked out. And part of it's because there's so much going on in the world. And I want to get to this, but I also want to just wrap up a tiny bit on the AA and the rectification of wrongs. because that is the process, and it's the one we most always want to leave out, because we come from an immature judgmental culture, an immature judgmental species, and our maturity is very dependent upon evolving beyond simplistic judgmentalness. Yes, you have to have judgment. Yes, you need to make judgments. But they move, and they move according to your receptivity to the world around you and the input that comes in and the experiences that you have. When they become judgmental, the shutters close, the blinders tighten, and you become narrow-minded. Because all in defense of not having to see yourself or someone else upon whom your survival depends, or who you love, like a parent or a caretaker. So there are lots of reasons why we all have these traumas, and they're varied. That's a given. I really don't think you can get to be here without them. And most of the people who walk around trying to act like they don't have any wounds almost always are people, and some of them have worked on a great deal and broken through a great and processed a great deal, and that's wonderful. But many have just developed ways of dominating, and that's what dominant behavior comes from. You really don't have an interest in power for power's sake, which is what domination is about, and arguing over, unless you're wounded, because it's functionally dysfunctional. I remember hearing somebody say how, you know, I think it came out of George Orwell, where, you know, people are interested in power for power's sake and control for control's sake and money for money's sake, like a scorecard for their importance. And this is sad because this is displacement once again. So you can see we have a lot of cultural issues that are more than just what each of us are going through alone. There is a collective compounding of certain things that have caused us to move collectively into really quite astounding denial. It's really astounding. And blatant, and you can tell somebody the truth, and they can see it right before their eyes, and some will just deny they see it. Others will say, yeah, I see it, but in 30 seconds, it's forgotten. Literally, they forget it. And they replace it with another yes, but, and how about, and another thing to rile you up, to distract you. And you'll see this in the media all the time. An interviewer will ask a politician or someone a question. They won't answer the question. They'll veer off into something else that's very upsetting or annoying or polarizing, and they'll get everybody derailed, and nobody will notice they didn't answer the question, and it goes on, and everybody's upset, and the channel, I call it changing the channel. They will have changed the channel to the escapist channel. Whereas, to get back to our listener's question, how do we do it to ourselves? Well, you change the channel too, but you change it back to the channel of being real. You change it back to the channel of being receptive. You change it back to the channel of innocence, slowing down, listening more deeply, allowing yourself to just empathize and feel the other person's point of view, whether you're going to end up agreeing with them or not. At least get their side of the interpretation clearly before you're building a case against it. And that will slow you down. It will. And sometimes people will be giving you really bad cases. And you'll slow down and you'll listen, and then you'll find that annoying that you did it. But no, what's happened is you're clearer about that case. You know why that doesn't work. And so you always then have room to listen. Maybe you'll hear the same old story, but maybe you'll hear one new ingredient, one new piece of information that's necessary to know. You know, I've often used the analogy of the body for the body of humanity. Church uses the body, calls it the church, the body of Christ, from the Christian Catholic Church, and the there's also the sense, so the metaphor of humanity itself as an organism, as a single organism, and that all the people in humanity are cells of the body, and they all have different jobs. They're not supposed to be all the same. They're supposed to have different talents, different natures, different qualities, different things to do. So the first order of business of trying to make them all the same is a sure way to kill us all. Just like in your body, if we tried to turn every cell into your body into a bone cell, or a brain cell, or a muscle cell, you know, or a stomach cell, you'd be dead. We need the interaction. We need the differences. So that's a number one good aspect of the metaphor. There's many, actually, if you start to think about it. But very importantly is our new understanding of immune system dysfunction, where immune systems speed up and cause one kind of disease, or they slow down and they cause another kind of disease. And that's the way they sort of express it medically. But actually, instead of speeding up and slowing down, it is more the speeding up is attacking incorrectly, attacking and annihilating and ganging up inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases. It's like attacking the wrong thing. And then the slow is more denial. It's not seeing it. It's ignoring it. So there's something going on, a cancer cell developing or several in a particular area, which happens, by the way, all the time. These influences of the environment and viruses and weaknesses in our own body and difficulties and stress all create abnormal cells all the time. The good news is our body, our immune system says, oops, that one's growing out of whack. That's not right. Let's gobble that one up, make some new ones that are healthy. It's paying attention to the body. It's listening and moving in when something starts to develop in a way that is not healthy to the whole, which is degenerate, abnormal, harmful. So the two aspects of the immune system are too fast, too slow, too hot, too cool. This is denial, escapism, and violence, attack, projection, and blame. The job is always to find the balance again. So using the metaphor in the world, let's say with terrorists, well, when you try to use even the language, which is so incorrect, it's a nonsense statement, actually, and it's amazing how few people noticed it right from the beginning. In the very beginning, it almost like hurt my head. You cannot have a war on terror. You can't have a war on a behavior or on a propaganda, violent thing. You can't have a war on that. War is one state against another, one organization against another, literally speaking about wars. And so, okay, so you say, well, it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor of a war on terrorism. The only problem with that and with war altogether and these kinds of violence for violence, these attacking violence, is there's something I invented years and years and years ago called the emotional law of the universe, which is the law of matching energy. And what it is whatever you're feeling, you're sending. So it's actually quite refined and works in very subtle ways between people that can be very helpful, again, to our other listener, writer, about how do we change it. You know, we notice, you start to notice the ways in which you are trying to control or manipulate that are dysfunctional. And you know because there's a bad result. It doesn't feel good. Somebody's screaming. Somebody's upset. Maybe it's you. Doesn't matter. So something's off. So when we have a war kind of issue or a terrorist thing, our work is to heal, to speak to the healthiest people who are around the dysfunction. So the healthiest people on one side begin to speak to the healthiest people on the other side. And almost always, almost, perhaps always, there cannot be such a severe dysfunction on one side without there being a corollary dysfunction on the other side. It may not be the same kind. It may be one of denial and deficit or harm that nobody's paying attention to that's been done, but the people receiving the harm know. I heard somebody on TV use a Southern expression, and they were talking about politicians these days and the kind of harm that's being done, and people just putting their nose in the air and just acting like they just didn't do anything wrong at all. And I think it was about even Katrina or something, the lack of help, which still is there, or not there, better said, help is not there. But they said even a dog knows when you kick him on purpose. So when we hurt people on purpose, it is a degenerate act. Really, always, to hurt somebody on purpose, for the purpose of hurting, is ill, mentally ill. And I was thinking of a new bumper sticker, which is probably too gruesome, nobody'd want it, but that torture is always degenerate. It's a degenerative thing to do. And the point I was trying to get to all along on this is that things get worse and worse and worse till they get so bad. You wake up and you realize the person's not accidentally stepping on you. There's also a and stealing from you. There's also a measure of madness. There's a measure of degeneracy. There's a measure of mental illness. There's a measure of sadism. There's a measure of your absorbing it like a masochist. So I don't want to make any of these words all too heavy. I mean, they are heavy words, but I do mean what I'm saying. I mean what the words mean. And what we're doing is we're hurting each other. And we are hurting other people as a way to keep hurt away from us. And that doesn't work. It always comes back and gets you. Plus, you have become what you resist, which is an ancient Chinese proverb over 5,000 years old. You become what you resist. And that's why terrorism has escalated all over the world, by our absolutely immature and inept handling of terrorism. And much of it is done because people literally can't think of another way to do it. But of course, part of the reason why they can't think of another way to do it is they don't want to think of another way to do it. And they don't want to hear other people say they know other ways of doing it. Because it makes them wrong. It removes their ability to suck all that oxygen out of the air and make their point focus so that they don't have to look at themselves. And this has been going on with human beings for as long as we've had leaders and social organizations. This is not new. This is immature thinking. What's new is we are beginning collectively to consciously consider there's something wrong with this picture. There are other options. I can remember when Ronald Reagan was invading somewhere. I can't remember what it was at the time, but I was talking to someone who's a celebrity, by the way, but I won't mention names. But they said, well, I think you just can't think of anything else to do, and of course neither could they. And when you can't think of anything else to do except black and white and hit the tiniest little gnat with a giant sledgehammer or a bulldozer, you're going to cause a lot more damage to millions of innocent people. That's all going to rebound on you. And that's why we've made such a disaster in Iraq, is because they weren't the issue. They may have had problems, no doubt. We maybe needed to negotiate with them, observe them, deal with them, scrutinize them, have interactions that kept a better handle on what was happening and better light on the situation. But to go turn, to regress, to degenerate backwards into simplistic thinking comes from wounded, immature souls who do not know what they're doing, who are filled with absolute confidence because they will not look at anything else. And we biologically, socially, as beings, are somewhat organized, biologically, to follow the one that looks confident. Well, there's lots of forms of mental illness that make you confident. Megalomania, escapism, all kinds of things. And we have to collectively not be the children to the king. We need to be out of the feudal system and into the democratic system that was created by our founding fathers. And to be a democratic republic means that you truly democratically elect people to represent you and do the work at a more manageable level. And when they do not, you get them out, put some in that do. It does require that the population grow up. It requires in democracy that you be informed, that you be awake. And this isn't just about political information or being informed politically. We have moved collectively as a species to a whole social leap, a social psychological leap. They call it psychosocial. Anyway, a leap into really understanding our psychology in groupthink and the power we have as individuals, and that there be a maturer version than anything we've ever done before, and that the main characteristic of maturity is dealing with reality kindly and having the willingness to contemplate what's going on, contemplate yourself and your own actions and reactions, especially when they're angry or hostile, or are causing angry and hostile reactions to you. How do you, when somebody's being angry to you, you want to extend some empathy. That doesn't mean you agree. This is what we have to keep moving out of. We keep thinking that if we feel the other person will be swept away and we'll be wrong and they'll be right and we'll agree. Well, maybe they'll be right and you'll be wrong, but more often than not, you're both a little wrong and you're both a little right. And by empathy, you both figure out what's wrong and you both figure out what's right, and then you become a team creating what's right and letting go, and so by attrition it falls away, what's wrong. So there is something truly being born here. There's something bigger we are being asked to do. And the prices will be pretty yucky if we don't do it, because we actually are on the brink. We have the information available. It's here. And it's only a matter of will we squeeze it out, will we deny it. You know, I think in similar terms, like to talk about the war in Iraq, I remember myself included amongst many people, many, many people, warning about not including George Bush's father and James Baker. The reason his father didn't invade Iraq was because it was a can of worms. It would bring very little good result for doing it. Just gaining control over the weapons, which they did do, and by keeping the pressure on to have inspectors and negotiation and to keep the pressure on through interaction, which takes time-consuming, adult, patient, informed, historically informed, educated people to do this, caring people to do this. This is how we change the world, by interacting in this way. So when our president came in with no real understanding and just and emotionally wanting to get back, there was a previous agenda. It was mentioned long before 9/11, years before. And that this was an agenda before he was president. It was his agenda to go into Iraq. He said that he would. There's videotapes of it. Because it was an emotional issue for him, not an educated, healing, support of our country issue. It was a personal, emotional issue for him. And so people warned, and people explained, and people said it'll be a morass. We'll get caught in it because it'll just open up all these divisions, and there won't be enough security, and it'll take too much treasure in people and in American taxpayer money that people work so hard for. It will take too much away from our own healing of our own country. People said this. And people said that Osama bin Laden would be someone to really look out for, that this could happen. But they couldn't imagine someone would run into the plane, as Condoleezza Rice said. George Bush and all the right-wing people, I remember on Fox, they were talking about it, and I remember when George Bush was on the air carrier, mission accomplished, in his little suit, and Fred Barnes said, well, so much for all those liberal, some kind of insulting name, and their morass. You know, this morass we were supposed to get caught in. Of course, he's still on TV making pronouncements like he knows, and still no acknowledgement of that, no maturity, no sense of consequence and what one already said. We all make mistakes. That's not the issue. The issue is to say, oh yeah, I made a mistake, and my mistake was based on, so you share the information why you made the mistake so other people won't make the same mistake, or at least have some background knowledge on what might contribute to a mistake. This is mature. This is when you help each other grow so we all have a better home. We all have a better country. We all have a better world. And that everybody's involved. And yes, you take care of your family and your the people who are immediately close to you, who you deal with every day, in your family, with your pool of friends, with your workmates. You do your best to elevate the caliber of connection and communication. And if you do that, you become more creative. And if you do that, you begin to notice your own wounds and your own little areas of denial. And it becomes a gentle process, because these are friends and family. You can slow it down. It doesn't have to be hysterical and to the ramparts, you know, right away, to the big guns right away. It can be interactive. And in that way, you soften the dawn. You soften the transformation, the piercing of the veil, the next level of thinking and being. We are working on our own shadows personally as a single cell organism, and that's where the most power resides for each person. We have all been invested in seeing power out there to dispense us from working on ourselves. And you'll see it in small issues and big, in families, when people have one problem, you know, they'll get all in somebody else's problem in the family. Now, it isn't that we don't see other people's problems in our family seriously affect us, so that's fair too. And it's okay to bring things up. But when you bring them up, you have to check yourself out. Is this an emotional hand-wringing thing? Or am I looking at the emotion or the sadness it may bring up for me, but also trying to find another way to let it go, to heal it? Then you're moving to a mature position. This is another way of doing it. And that's what makes the transformation to the whole and steadily makes things better. You know, the other thing about true maturity and healing is you almost always, especially through the whole first three quarters of the process, get very little credit. Sometimes you may never get credit. And for the vast majority of what you do that's wonderful, you probably will not get any credit. So what? It makes you stronger. It makes you smarter. It makes you grounded. It makes you healthy. It makes you wise. It makes you creative. It makes you flexible. It makes you understand. It gives you empathy. It increases your ability and your talent. And you become supremely more creative than people around you. So what if you don't get the credit? You know? And it's okay to get credit. It's okay to even want it sometimes, especially when it starts to get way out of hand, in that you're allowing a lie to continue and people do things that are dishonest. Then the dishonesty has to be addressed. And maybe you can address it and you still won't really get the credit. But it's not an issue of credit. That's like winning. It's an issue of connection. It's an issue of empathy. It's an issue of the beauty and the intelligence of the loving connection between people. There are people you can love deeply and never, almost ever speak to them, but you know them, you sense who they are, you feel them, you love them, you know they have mistakes and things to grow because they're not exempt from the human race. But you love them. And you send them love all the time. Every time anything that reminds you of them or anything about them passes your mind, it's filled with love. This is healthiness. You don't need to own a person. You don't have to be with them. You don't have to make them do anything you want them to do. You can ask them to do anything you want them to do. And they'd be probably happy to know about it. And maybe they can say, yes to this part, no to that part, maybe to this part, and a big fat yes to this part. So, you know, in the end, that may be all that you ever really need. We can't know all this to be controllers. Very poor for us to get invested into the psychological defense of winning and controlling. Very poor thinking. Doesn't mean you can't win and control sometimes. But there's a leap happening where there's a more profound filling, a deeper revelation, and that's where all the creativity is. And that's where that great dawning is. That's what I call the evolutionary leap.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copyrighted to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.